sometime in the 1980s, someone decided to sort of pimp my classical architecture, if you will.
Welcome, construction industry professionals. You're listening to The Art of Construction, specifically designed for contractors and architects to grow your business. Here are your hosts, Devin and Kevin.
Kevin, we're going to dive in and have a chat with Christine Frank, who is, her accolades go on and on from her website, and I'm so excited to get in and peel back some layers. I'm sure we'll learn a few things by an expert in the, as a designer and all the, a teacher, a true teacher in the industry.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see the new program that she started at CU that really is going to kind of be a leader, I think, in the country for architectural design and everything. So yeah, really looking forward to that.
Yeah, and you know, her with the ICA that we had Chad Cox on, and good job, Adam Sinclair, one of our sales reps here in Mountain View. We're all out networking and collaborating with the people that were doing the same thing, and I think we're definitely going to have that out of Christine.
Well, and I think the interesting thing about her background is she blends both the theoretical from the educational side to the practical aspect and everything in between, because she's out there actually designing and working on buildings on a regular basis. You know, not daily, but certainly on a regular basis to understand and to be able to take those and bridge the gap between the two, which we don't get to see very often.
Well, let's dive in and have a chat with Christine Frank, who has developed Carta and accolades that go on and on. So let's just dive in and have a chat.
Here we go.
So what's your favorite beverage?
My favorite beverage is probably a glass of claret in England on a foggy night.
That sounds delightful.
Yeah.
All right. What's the favorite place you've traveled?
Rome, without question.
Tell us about that.
Rome is extraordinary. It's the most extraordinary city on Earth that we've built over thousands of years. As you go back and dig through the layers of Rome, you see the history of different places and people. You see the most extraordinary architecture and artwork and urbanism. It is a complete work of art, the city.
I have a friend of mine that's over traveling, and he's a big Facebook guy. So it's been so fun to watch him. It's his 20 pictures of doors every day.
Yeah.
And he's not a door guy. He owns a painting company. But It's just the architecture grabs everybody when you go to those
places.
It does. Right?
It really does. Yep.
So what's your favorite hobby?
Oh, I knit. I'm a knitter. I'm a yarn person.
Great. Cool. So we got through the speed round.
Okay.
All right. So Christine Frank, I've been doing a lot of research on your website, and the accolades are insurmountable, and we're really honored to have you in there. But
thank you.
Kind of the about on your website is you're a designer, author, and educator with a practice focusing on custom residential design and decoration.
Mm-hmm.
Is that fair on the website? And tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah. I have, over the last 20, 25 years, ended up kind of dividing my work and my practice between education and design. Sometimes I've been heavier on the design side, sometimes heavier on the education side. I've been in Denver now for a little over a year and a half, and came here in order to set up a new research center at the University of Colorado Denver. So my practice is a little bit pushed to the side, although I'm happy to say that I'm getting ready to work on my first house here in Colorado, which
exciting,
is very
right?
different than thinking about designing and building in the East. So, and particularly in the Southeast, it's the land is different. You know, we're up on the Palmer Divide. You have the view of the mountains to the outside. You have no trees on the site. It's relatively flat. It's completely different than, say, designing on the East Coast in a beachfront environment.
Sure.
So I am still doing some design work, but my primary role here in Denver is to set up this research center.
So. And where are you from when you say from?
I'm from Williamsburg, Virginia, and have lived between there and New York City. I lived in New York for about 18 years.
Wow.
I went up there, actually. I know you had Chad Cox, the president of our ICA Rocky Mountain
yes.
chapter, on. I went to New York in 1997 to be the very first executive director of the Institute of Classical Architecture and Art. And for many years, into the early 2000s, ran all of our academic programs for the ICA, which is a kind of shorthand for the long name, Institute
yeah.
of Classical Architecture and Art.
I still have to think about it.
It doesn't exactly just roll off the tongue, which is why a lot of us default back to just calling it the ICA. But I ran our academic programs for a long time, served on our national board of directors, left New York, took a nice two-year sabbatical back at home in Virginia, in Williamsburg, Virginia, the old colonial Williamsburg that a lot of people are familiar with. And then ended up moving out here to set up this research center.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I want to start out by some different questions as far as doing some research. Tell us about the historic house in Texas you renovated.
Yeah.
I wanted something totally off the wall to start with as far as, you know, us in Colorado when we make these shows global and timeless. So historic in Texas, everything's bigger in Texas. Tell us about that project.
Well, that's a good intro because, in fact, the reason we ended up renovating this house is because at one point earlier, someone had tried to sort of take the everything is bigger in Texas approach to the house. Okay. So a lot of your listeners are probably familiar with architecture of the early 20th century, say 1920s, 1930s, that we would call colonial revival. All the houses that you see that sort of look a little like Mount Vernon or are red brick with white trim that are from the early 20th century, those architects and builders were trying to revive a kind of idea of Williamsburg and of our early colonial foundings. So we have a revival of different colonial styles in the early 20th century. And in Texas, this particular area around one of the country clubs there had a number of really beautiful old colonial revival houses built in the 20s and 30s. Its proportions were very slender, just had a very sort of calm, elegant look to it. Sometime in the 1980s, someone decided to sort of pimp my classical architecture, if you will. You know, the columns weren't flamboyant enough. The trim around the windows wasn't enough. And so they went in and they replaced the columns, which had been beautiful, old. We think they were probably actually wood stave columns with an Ionic capital. They went in and put really not very good cast stone columns with big, flamboyant classical Corinthian capitals on it. They ripped out the old windows and the beautiful brickwork around the windows and put in stone lintels and casings around the windows that, again, were not very well designed. They put a really awful new cornice on the house. Now, they thought they knew what they were doing, but they really could have stood to have taken some classes from the ICA. So a colleague of mine, Brent Hall, who is a millworker in Texas and also a builder and designer and really extraordinary person, he's written a great book that would be great for your show, Building a Timeless House in an Instant Age. I think we're going to have Brent here speaking at some point in the future. So
beautiful. Yeah, we run a message board, so any of that kind of stuff, we'll make sure Kevin will take notes of that, and we'll put it on the link on our website.
So Brent was approached about renovating the house. He called me and asked for a little extra help, and I sent back a sketch and said, well, here's what we can make it look like pretty easily. Sent that back. The clients liked it so much, we went ahead, and it ended up being a pretty significant renovation to the house. But it really shows, if you look at the original house and the 1980s kind of overblown classicism, and then how we were able to bring it back to a well-informed, well-designed classical house, it really shows the importance of learning about how to use that language of classical architecture.
Yeah, that's really
great. And we won some good awards for it, so.
That's good to have accolades from it, for sure. Chad Cox on the Art of Construction and mm-hmm. been learning a lot about the ICAA, and Mountain View is really becoming very, you know, very passionate and wanting to get more involved. And as I'm learning as far as how colleges and things are working, as far mm-hmm. as I've correct, Notre Dame's the only one that has a full classical program, right?
Right.
So you're here at CU, and as I'm learning and talking with different education, and, you know, I talk with my Mountain View family about a learning environment mm-hmm. and how can we learn about all this stuff that is kind of being missed. And that's what I've been seeing, and as I've been talking with different members of the ICAA, they're really bringing classical art and architecture to the forefront. So
yeah.
Can you kind of talk about that and maybe some shed some light about what you're doing with CU and how architects listening to this, maybe
sure.
ones that have been in the market for a long time to get involved, or students, like we're really big in wanting to maybe have an internship program and
mm-hmm.
talk about the tour that you got here at Mountain View with maybe bringing students in and really teaching that and working together to grow
that
segment.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of the architects listening, and probably even some of the contractors, they probably wonder, well, what is this stuff that you're talking about, classical and traditional architecture? Isn't that stuff that they did a long time ago? We don't build things like that anymore today. And that's not the style of today. Today is more modernist architecture, or sort of architecture that's been inherited through the modernist tradition to today. Why would anyone design an old-fashioned house today? So people, when they hear the word traditional or classical, they think of something historical. And while we can learn a lot from historical buildings, what's happening for a large segment of architectural practice, for home builders, for urban designers, and now for students too, is that they're kind of realizing that when we sort of threw the baby out with the bathwater during the Bauhaus and stopped teaching anything about traditional architecture, traditional methods of building, traditional ways of composing a facade, traditional building typologies, when we stopped that sort of living tradition in its tracks, we lost a lot of knowledge. And what we're realizing now, as we begin to have to confront things like building in a way that addresses climate change, for example, or building in a way that tries to mitigate the impact of suburban development. So building in more traditional patterns, like cities and towns and villages that are walkable, that are dense, and the architecture that goes with that, the architecture that supports people moving easily along a street. An architecture that is local, that speaks to place, that uses local materials. An architecture that has different roof forms in the southeast than it does in the southwest because the climate is different. These are lessons from traditional architecture that we have every capacity to learn today, but that students don't have an opportunity to learn, and that most practitioners practicing today probably didn't learn in school either. Although they have, in many cases, I think many architects today have begun to realize that there are valuable lessons from our diverse architectural traditions, and they do look to learn from those and incorporate them into their practice. So bringing students in here, for example, and
we say here, we're in Mountain Showroom in Denver, Colorado,
yeah.
That, you know, gave us a lot of nice comments from the showroom, so we really appreciate that,
yeah.
And you know, maybe shed a few lights to the listeners out there, things that you saw or jumped out at you.
Yeah, well, you know, things like you've done here in the showroom by, you know, showing, leaving things open so that whether it's architects or clients, or even if we can bring our students in here, students can actually see how things are built, sort of what goes on behind the wall. So much of what you appreciate about architecture is when it's done, and yet so much of what architecture depends on is being built well from the
inside out. The longevity of the house is what you don't see.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, I think that was one of the really neat things, was seeing how you've really turned the showroom into a learning experience for the people that you have coming in here, and I hope we can share that with our students. So, right.
So what you're saying with respect to the importance of classical architecture really doesn't define itself solely by a classical look.
No. And that's an important distinction. I'm involved with the center that we've established at the University of Colorado Denver is purposefully called the Center for Advanced Research in Traditional Architecture, or CARTA for short. And with CARTA, what we're looking at is really taking the position that there is valuable knowledge that's contained in the traditional ways that we have over thousands of years built places and buildings. And we should and can learn from that. And not to replicate it, not to copy, but to take the best of the knowledge that we have from the past, marrying it with the best of the science and technology and skills that we have today, and use that to address and solve the issues we have today. We don't need to reinvent the wheel every Monday morning, which is what a lot of architecture does, is kind of reinvent the wheel every Monday morning. So when we talk about the difference between classical and traditional architecture, most Americans and Western Europeans, when they speak about classical architecture, they're talking about specifically the architecture that starts in Greece and Rome and transmits through Western Europe and ultimately lands sort of on our shores here in America. Everything from our capital in Washington, D.C., to our capital here in Denver, Colorado, are classical buildings. So there is a sort of highest style which is the classical in the West. And then there are a whole lot of different vernacular traditions that have underlaid that, and the traditional is sort of where those two meet. Take, for example, architecture of the Southwest, where there was an existing native vernacular tradition of building, say, a pueblo, or building in adobe. So that's a native tradition that has developed of that place. And then you add on top of that, for example, Spanish colonists coming in. And you get this merging, this fascinating merging of the traditional construction of the adobe with the formal classicism of the Spanish, and you get a completely new architecture that we would think of as a traditional architecture in that place. So awesome. it's a little
so
complicated.
As we were walking around, I loved how you were talking about how we know as much of our predecessors, but we don't make things as beautiful as they did. We were talking a lot of different things about walking through the showroom, but it's kind of like a throwaway environment versus making it to last. But then we kind of talked about how CNC and technology is there to give the look. And I think, isn't that kind of a big part of what you live and breathe and with the ICAA, kind of making people think about that kind of stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's a couple very important things there in your question. One is the culture that we find ourselves in today. And we have, for the last maybe 50 to 100 years, really come to live in this very disposable throwaway culture. We're now really starting to understand that we really can't live like that much longer. We can't endure unless we actually build and make places that endure. And I think we're seeing this not just in architecture, but we're seeing this in everything from the fact that people are willing to pay a little bit more money for organic food. People are really conscious about making sure they buy food that is local because they understand the impact of shipping bananas from South America. Because they don't just come from South America, they go all the way around the globe before they get here on a shipping container. People are starting to understand that in a world that has become so globalized, where every place looks like every other place, that's when people start to sort of step back and look for their own identity. So you see a lot of places and people seeking to discover the traditions of their place. It's why heritage travel and tourism is so high. People really seek authenticity, and authenticity is hard when you manufacture something that you're going to throw away in 7 years.
Yeah, I loved how Chad Cox said you can't fake authenticity.
Yeah, no, you really can't.
You can make it similar, but you know, you gotta have your ducks in a row. And I think that's a key comment of the kind of the old and the new and blending everything together.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I think one of the mistaken criticisms of contemporary, traditional, and classical architecture is that it's just about copying the past, or that the craftsmen are all dead. They're not. I know a lot of them, and they're not dead. I guarantee you, they're young and they're hip, and they're actually enjoying getting into doing things like working with their hands. But it's also not about being regressive or about turning away from technology and advancement and knowledge. The really ironic thing about traditional architecture today is it's turning out to be the most radical proposition that we can make in terms of how we should be thinking about and making our built environment in the future, to take old ideas and sort of make them new. And we have every technology and capability at our disposal today, plus thousands of years of history of how to build well and how to create beauty and how to build buildings that last. We should be borrowing and learning from everything. We shouldn't limit what we learn from.
Christine, tell us a little bit about your use of Baldwin hardware and the related competition that goes with that.
Oh, sure. In part, I think, from growing up in Williamsburg, Virginia, where Baldwin Brass did candlesticks and decorative lighting, I had always been aware of the Baldwin name. I didn't really understand until just recently that that was part of the original company that is Baldwin Hardware, and that at some point in the past they split apart. But I'd always loved Baldwin. I loved Baldwin Hardware for the fact that they were making really good quality hardware that was sort of stylistically similar to a lot of the work that I was doing. And hardware is really that kind of jewelry. It's that final little touch of jewelry on the house. And so I did a project a number of years ago called Chadsworth Cottage, and It was done as a show house. We used Baldwin Hardware for it. And just recently, I got a note from someone on Houzz. I have a site on Houzz, like mm-hmm. everybody does these days. And someone said, hey, this is some great Baldwin hardware. You should enter it in the Show Us Your Baldwin Hardware competition. So I did. I just sent in a picture and my name, and then they got in touch and asked a few more questions, and I sent them a few more pictures, and I won. Huh. So I was their first Show Us Your Baldwin Hardware winner. Chadsworth Cottage was. Really great time, actually fascinating time visiting with the Baldwin folks out in California. We went out for a couple of days and had an amazing tour of their facilities there. And talk about someone, they've got the top industrial design guys because they're pulling out of the California market. They're using the newest and best modeling technology to design what they're doing. They're using really fascinating 3D printers that I hadn't even seen before, in some cases able to actually print in metal. And they're doing all of this to model, their new lines and to test. And it's a perfect example of what I'm talking yeah. about, where they do plenty of modernist-inspired lines, but they also are doing their traditional yeah. lines. And in both cases, they're using the best of technology for today to determine what they build. So
yeah, and we're a Baldwin dealer here.
Yeah, I saw that.
It's complicated because they have so many options, but that makes it so great for the design element. And that's what we welcome here right. in the luxury world, is
right.
we want to be able to do the modern style or the different styles you're talking about and have it all integrate together to all work seamless together.
Yeah,
and the jewelry you're talking about, different hardware on different doors.
Yeah, and you really, it's one of those, it is a kind of luxury thing to be able to do when you're designing something, to be able to really finesse, the shape of a doorknob and its finish and what kind of rose it has behind it. I worry about all of those things when I'm designing a house,
right, yeah.
every last detail. Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Which a lot of people don't even know what a rose that is, right?
No.
and a lot of that stuff, that's our job, is to be the experts, and that's
right.
what we're always talking about
right.
on the show, is to that the customer just walks into the room and it's all right. And
yeah.
because we did the glazing stops on the windows to the rosettes
right.
on the hardware, all those details all blend and work together.
Well, and this is the thing, whether it's the hand that reaches out and opens and closes a door and they touch that doorknob of their house every single day, or whether it's fixing the latch on your windows and cranking open your windows every single day, people do not realize how much they're interacting with their buildings on a daily basis and how important it is that things like their windows and their hardware are really well designed to actually be touched.
We see so much interest in the modern look, and noticed on your website that you referenced a book by George Smith talking about it, the Treatise on Modern Architecture. Maybe you can give a little bit of a description of that and kind of how that plays in with...
Sure. It's a clever title. This is a new book by George Samaras Smith, who is an English architect who works with the company of Adam Architecture. And it's a treatise on modern architecture. And if you open the pages, you will see it's full of the classical orders. One of the things that we have to do is kind of reclaim what the word modern means. Modern doesn't mean a style. Modern just means that it's contemporary, that it's happening today.
Hmm.
So George Samaras Smith decided to publish a new treatise looking at the classical orders, and both how they're designed and how they're used in composition. So it's probably not what you were thinking it was, but a good title on his part. So,
yeah, gotcha.
Yeah.
Tell us about the most unique project you've worked on in the past 12 months.
Oh, without question. It's developing the Center for Advanced Research in Traditional Architecture. It's a little bit like running a startup. I was brought out here specifically by the dean of the College of Architecture and Planning in order to set up this center so that the faculty at CU who are interested in traditional architecture and the students who are interested in it can have an opportunity to learn about traditional architecture. So we've had to develop the, sort of the vision for the program. What does the center look like? What does the center do? We've had to put together our strategic plan as far as fundraising because we have to raise all the money to do it. It's really exciting to see the reaction of the provost and the chancellor who really get, normal people get the idea. And I say that by saying normal people, not architects. Normal people really get the idea that students should be learning about traditional methods of construction and building and composition.
So is this building started?
We're not making a building. We're housed in the College of Architecture and Planning. Perhaps okay. in the future we'll actually design and build something that would put our principles in practice. But what we've been able to do over the last year to year and a half is bring in speakers from around the world to talk to the students. We developed the college's very first career fair. The College of Architecture and Planning had not held a career fair before. But when my colleagues in traditional and classical architecture around the country found out there were students interested in this, they called up and said, if you just have a career fair, we'll come and be there. Because they are so desperate for students who have any training at all in traditional architecture. They are so desperate to hire, and they really have a hard time hiring from other schools. There are, by the way, at the University of Texas, San Antonio, Mississippi State University, Judson College, which is a small Christian college in the Midwest, also University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. There are teachers and students who are, I'm starting to sort of find them. One of the things we've done with CARDA is we've launched the very first International Student Design Awards project, Design Awards program focused on traditional and classical architecture. So we're getting entries from all over the world of students that have never had really an opportunity to have their work recognized at all. So it's exciting because I feel like CU is really on the forefront of architecture today.
I totally agree because, you know, being involved with AIA and different organizations, it's like ICAA definitely has its spot because they don't really have, when I go to the different awards, there isn't, you know, this week is the Crystal Awards for ASID. There's no classical design award. It's all about the modern movement on these awards.
Yeah, and that's something that one of the stated goals of CARDA is to bridge the currently impassable gap between the classical and the traditional and the modernist in architecture today. It's as if there's two parallel universes of architecture. In urban design, it's already really shifted. For example, Denver is the largest city in America to adopt a form-based code, which is something that grows out of the Congress of New Urbanism and the movement of New Urbanism, which is a movement that has looked back to traditional urban design to figure out how to design today, because they looked at what we were doing in conventional suburban development, saw the negative impact of that, and have tried to learn things from the past to figure out how to design and build better places today. So urban designers, they've already figured it out. Planners, they've figured it out. Architects, I think, could open up their minds a little bit to what they have available to them to learn from. And that's hopefully, we'll start to see, this is one of the things CARDA wants to do, is to host some debates and discussions about these different views of architecture and try to find some common ground between them so that both sides are better.
What's the best way, Christine, for our listeners, both architects and builders that might have an interest in this, what's the best way for them to reach out and get involved?
Sure. Well, I think for the professional audience, one of the things that we'll be developing in the next year is both classes at CU that are continuing in professional education classes that will focus on teaching about traditional architecture, whether it's construction techniques or whether it's compositional techniques, kind of the full range, and even just about the ideas behind it. And we will be developing those courses initially in person through CU's Continuing and Professional Education program, and then eventually those will be online. And right now there is nothing in that market. There is no way for someone to go online and learn about different traditional aspects of architecture. So we will be we hope to be the first to the market with that. So
that's cool. That's great.
So that would be the best way for them to find us and engage. And as far as if they want to learn more about this, we're going to have a symposium this fall. We've got people coming in from around the world to discuss these ideas. So that would be another good way for professionals to engage as well.
And then do you, through the ICAA, are there local courses or seminars that they can...
Yeah, what we're kind of doing with the ICAA, with the local Rocky Mountain chapter, and I should say, if you have listeners in other places, the ICAA has chapters. I think we have 16 chapters around the country now, and they're all active. They all do slightly different things, but here in the Rocky Mountain chapter, we do our columns and coffee tours, which are free for members and a great way to sort of explore behind the scenes of architecture that you wouldn't otherwise see. The classes, the sort of educational component, is something that we'll be handling through CARTA and through CU. But I sit on our board of our ICA chapter, and so we're working in very close concert to make sure that the programs that we're offering are classes that will also be eligible for people to earn the ICA certificate in classical architecture.
Yeah, and that's a big goal of the Art of Construction, this podcast, is to bring different people together that share the same passions. And like you said, bring your students into our showroom. We have a full learning, you know, education center here with the screens and all that kind of stuff, because it's all about finding the right people that want to collaborate and work together on those type of projects.
So. Yeah. You know, it's funny, the you were asking about the modernist, classical divide, or what would some of your audience members who might be more modernist architects, what would they have to learn from this long-dead language, let's say? It's interesting because when we started the Institute in New York, it was a bunch of kids who really wanted to learn about this stuff, but hadn't had an opportunity to learn about it in school. We had no idea what the Institute was going to become. You know, that when I went up as our executive director, our annual budget was $250,000 a year. We run nationally, our national budget, not even including our chapter budgets, is now something like over $6 or $7 million a year. We have thousands of members. We started out with, you know, maybe 25 of us.
started the whole thing.
One of the group of people that was involved very early. We have a group of people that we would call sort of our founders: Richard Cameron, Donald Ratner, Richard Sammons, and Ann Fairfax. And I joined them 3 or 4 years after they had gotten started with the program. But when we started the Institute, there was a very clear kind of mandate that we held for ourselves, which was just simply that regardless of the work that you do, you can benefit from learning about the classical language. And it's a little like, if you're going to speak Italian, you will speak better Italian if you have studied some Latin.
Exactly.
Astonishing, because architecture is really the only professional field that has forgotten its past. You don't go to medical school and not learn about all of the things that current medicine is based on. And learning about classical and traditional architecture in a history class is not the same as learning how to design and build in these traditional ways. Similarly, music education is something that I look to a lot to see how musicians are educated in terms of how we should be educating architects. And it's if you go to study, you want to be a jazz musician, but you go study at, the Manhattan School of Music, you're going to spend the first couple of years of your time there in composition classes where you learn to compose like Mozart. So you don't go out and compose your own jazz before you actually know how to compose like Mozart and compose like Beethoven and compose like Copland. You actually learn how to compose by learning how other people have composed.
Totally.
And that's similar to what we could be doing in architecture, to at least in terms of the compositional part.
Well, in peeling back the layers, when you learn the history, like when I'm working with architects on remodel jobs, like the one you talked about with the Texas one that went from the original to changing and kind of going back to the original.
Yeah.
If you know what, I'm always talking to my Mountain View family about, we have to train you, your mind, to look at a window and door on a retrofit application and see behind the wall. Well, you can't just do that without tearing it apart, and sometimes we get to tear it apart, and that makes it a lot easier. But usually you don't get to do that, so we have to work together as the supplier and the architect for what's the finished result, not knowing behind that wall. Well, if you educate yourself and know about the histories of how stuff was done, you have a one-up by doing that.
Yeah, and I think it becomes really important when we start to address issues of sustainability and durability, because all we have to do is just open our eyes and look. Look at what we've built for the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years, and look at what we built 50, 100, 200 years ago. And there's a significant difference. You can go into an old house and see windows that are 200 years old if they've been painted and kept up on a regular basis. And maybe they've had to have the ropes on the pulleys replaced once. Today, windows not lasting that long, right?
Especially the certain vinyl windows are they make them knowing 3 to 5 years.
Right.
They make them as cheap as they possibly can, and it's all about the 1 year warranty.
Right.
And everyone knows in 5 years, whoever bought that house has to redo all the windows in the house, or they're not going to be performing well. That's a big expense,
and
because now you got to tear out all this other stuff, or you do another lick and stick model that in 5 years you're going to have the same problem again because it didn't get done right the second time.
It's
big, just a constant throwaway mentality.
It's a big expense for the homeowner, and it's one they're not going to be expecting, because they're probably not going to look and realize that their cheap vinyl windows only have a 3 year warranty. But it's also a big expense for our environment, because all those windows, there's more than likely no requirement for recycling. All of those windows are going to end up in a landfill, and then all the new effort that's going to be put into manufacturing and making those new windows. I think we have a responsibility, a deep responsibility, and I don't think it's about traditional or classical or modern. We have a really deep responsibility to build better than we have been building.
That's one of the reasons here in the Mountain View showroom, we're always talking to our potential customers about good, better, and best. And and one of the things through, a product like Anderson, that they're not only using a significant amount of recycled products, materials in their products, but we have products that are available that will last a significantly longer period of time than the much, much less expensive products. So, and can have that done in an architectural, can be placed in an architectural environment that's going to preserve help preserve a 100-year-old home to make it more energy, efficient.
Yeah. And the sustainability part, and Anderson's looking at it, you got to make money on it too. You can't, the whole green, friendly, sustainability thing. Mm-hmm. There's got to be concepts and reality behind that. And, we just took 43 architects back to Bayport, Minnesota, and things that the architects, I just watched their eyes light up when they talked about the fact that they had so much extra wood and waste and all this stuff. Instead of just throwing it away, they built their own steam plant, which heats the whole place. And then they integrated the Anderson 100 series, which is all made out of the 400 series vinyl and the wood pieces and reusing to make new product lines to where there's almost no waste. So they're recapturing and they're making good money off of that, but it's so friendly as well.
And that becomes really important in how you educate architects and builders and even clients, because they need to understand sort of what's behind the products that they're buying. So much of the way we operate in this world today is only to be the receiver of the end product, and we don't have a lot of knowledge a lot of times about what goes into a product before it gets to us. And that's where it becomes really important, the kind of process of education throughout a design project.
Yeah, and me personally, it's seeing is believing. And then when you see it, like in the showroom where you see behind the wall how that all went in, or you go back to the manufacturing plant and get to know the person, because at the end of the day, it's all about us people working together. But seeing is believing. When you see all this stuff live, how friendly they're being to the environment is pretty cool.
Well, and I think there's in the educational realm, there's educating students, and as professionals, we're always learning. Anyone who's engaged in actually doing something should always be learning the newest things. But with things that are important, I think, for people who are engaged in design to be constantly learning about, one side is the sustainability issues related to the production of products that are going into their buildings. we need to be using things that can be done in a way that is long-term, durable, and sustainable. Part of sustainability is actually making places and buildings that people love, that they're going to be willing to preserve and hold on to. And part of the recipe, if you will, for creating places that will be long-lived is to actually create places that have some resonance with the place, that give a sense of place. And in terms of education, I think one of the things that I've said this to you, I think, in our initial emails, windows, in the end, become one of the most important. Of course, they're one of the most important parts of the wall system in terms of the performance and durability of the building. But the composition of the windows, both the size of the opening, how that opening is divided, how the sashes are divided, whether it's a casement window, all of these decisions have really big impacts on the reading of the design of the building. If you picture a 5-bay colonial house and you think of it having 1/1 windows, that's going to have a really different reading than, say, 9/9 or 12/12 windows. Those are different compositional effects of those different windows. And we can achieve different characters of building just by something as seemingly simple as how we design the windows in the building. And when we achieve a character that's appropriate to a place, then we're able to help people enhance the sense of place that they have. Yeah. So you'd never think about just the design part of a window is actually being important in this recipe, but it is. It's not just about personal expression. It's also about making things that fit.
And it's funny when you say that, because I think back when I first got in this industry, I was writing, I was like, I'm going to do a spec house because you learn by doing. And I was like getting my windows, and I was like, well, I can't do white windows, so I did the big upgrade tan vinyl windows. And then I was like, well, I got to do grids. And I was like, well, I can't just do the standard production colonial grids, which I didn't even know what 8/8 meant. I was like, well, right, these little ones with the edge are cool. I'm going to do the one with the edge, you know, the prairie grids.
Right, right, right.
And now I sit here and listen. I listen now knowing all this stuff.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, how do you go through just grids or muttons or whatever you want to call it in details, TDLs, SDLs,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That little detail of a window changes the look of the whole house.
And it does.
And someone, yeah. I sit with people and they're just like, do you want grids? What's grids? Sure, throw them in. Well, what kind? Just put something in there. That's more like that than the other side of, well, don't do it if you don't know what you're doing.
Right.
First off.
Right. And please and don't just put them between the glass. That's just.
Yeah, right.
This gives me hives.
I sit and look at, you know, I guess to toot my own, how far I've come from just sitting and caring. You know, at the end of the day, I wanted to know just a colonial grid between the glass wasn't good enough for me.
Yeah.
And just going from that one step, I've went past what a lot of people do to learning what an SDL and a TDL and 5/8 to 7/8 to 1/8 to all those different sizes and prairie versus craftsman versus this versus that. And that's where we want to be the experts for that. And that's what we've set up in this showroom and on the Art of Construction and working with manufacturers like Anderson's, where they do pattern books and talk about a craftsman style in a craftsman style house. You're going to go through and say, these are the type of grids that you would see in a craftsman house. And that's really helpful, I think, for someone when you're starting from
and,
scratch.
You know, I think one of the things that I've done a lot of work over the years with the AIBD, the American Institute of Building Designers, which is a kind of parallel organization. It's like the AIA, but it's for residential designers, so people who are not architects. 95% of the houses designed in this country are not designed by architects. They're designed by these guys, by AIBD guys. And they're doing everything from designing and selling plans to in plan books, like you see in Sunset Homes, to doing custom work and operating very much in the way a custom residential architect would operate. And one of the things that's interesting with them is that they're very market-focused and market-driven. And they're going to design what a client and customer is going to buy. So a lot of their work is very traditional. And I developed a set of programs with the Institute of Classical Architecture for them. And we took a very simple approach. We said, look, if you're going to design a Georgian-style house, then let's help you design a Georgian-style house well. And if you're going to design a Tudor Beethen pile, then let's help you know what that style comes from and what things should look like what. And one of the things I found interesting in the classes that we ran for them was that they were all really focused on getting the thinnest mutton possible. And so I started to talk to them, I'm like, well, why is that so important? Well, you know, historically, it'd be really correct for the mutton to be really thin. And if any of the AIBD guys are listening, they know I love them. So I'm just kind of picking on them a little bit with this issue. But what had happened for a long time in the window industry is that there was a desire coming from architects to be able to get a thinner and thinner mutton. But there's no real basis for that in history. In the Greek Revival period, muttons became very thin and very projecting from the glass. I mean, they're almost like little knives. Yeah. But if you go back and you start to look at Federal and Georgian, sort of American Georgian style muttons, they're much wider and fatter. And one of the things that's important is to realize that it, when one is designing a window today or specifying a window, and selecting a mutton type, it's not about being correct with your style, but it's actually about understanding why a wide mutton reads differently than a narrow mutton, and why a 12 over 12 window looks different than a 6 over 6, or looks different than the perimeter or sort of prairie style division of the window into lights, and how that works, how the composition of that works into the composition of the whole facade.
Well, we've
There's
got a whole
lot to know about windows.
You know, that reminds me of all the Anderson sketchbooks that we showed to the group back in Minnesota. Anderson's put together a sketchbook for all these different styles that show just how that is put together, because what they found internally was is that as they were trying to get the windows to, you know, the structures to work for the different designs, they had the people in their architectural group doing all these sketchbooks and actually published the sketchbooks to go along with the whole program.
Yeah, so, I admire Anderson a lot. I've met some of their folks in the past, and I've never had the pleasure of using Anderson, but I admire where they are and what the area that they occupy in the window industry.
Yeah, I've got to know, his name's Jay Libby, who at Anderson, that designed these pattern books. And in Anderson of the old, they were very, very traditional, and say the expense of going through that whole thing. You know, Jay worked a long time putting those together, and they've really changed to where listening to architects a lot more, not to knock Anderson of the past, but they've just really opened up the breadth of, and then going and buying companies like Weiland and Eagle and KML, and really wanting to own the high end of the market, and understanding it's about people like you that understand the design and to work in collaboration. And Jay just did a great job, because a lot of people, if you don't know, ask the question. And that's what I teach my Mountain View family. It's the first question you ask somebody: what style of home are you going to build? And usually we don't get an answer. They're like here to buy windows from you, and they're still trying to figure out what style of home they're going to build.
And
so that's where, you know, Jay's books that he's developed with the Anderson team, the architects, and we brought them back to Bayport, they were like hoarding. They were like, is marketing
gold.
Yeah, guys who
typically wouldn't want to put anything else in their suitcase to come home, we're packing these things in their suitcases.
Well, and this is where, you know, one of the things I think is really important in the architectural industry is the lines of communication between the people who are designing and the people who are crafting and the people who are building. Historically, we weren't architects, we were master builders, right? We actually knew what things cost, how long it took to build them. We were kind of more like today's design build firms. When architects lose the connection with the manufacturers, and the manufacturers lose the connection with architects, and I think we have to put students in that mix too, you know, sort of the future architects, we start to lose architecture as the art of building, and it starts to become just the sort of process of assembly. And I think it's really important that we have the kinds of things like you guys are doing, of taking architects to the manufacturers and actually seeing them.
Yeah, we appreciate that. So on the flip side, what's the most unique project or challenging project that you've done in the past and recently?
I'll pick something that's very specific. Just 2 weekends ago, I went down with my partner, Cameron Kruger, and sited the house for these clients. It's a couple retiring from Connecticut. We're doing a new house for them down in Douglas County. And coming from the East Coast originally, and particularly from the South, where trees are never very far away from you, and you're always sort of closed in, and you have lots of topography to work with, it was really a challenge to find sort of the best slight rise of the site to locate the house. But we do have Pikes Peak to center on.
So you do have a mountain view.
We do. We have
that's
a mountain
they have
view.
A mountain view, man.
And Pikes Peak.
Yeah, we've got Pikes Peak to one side, and we can see Long's Peak to the other side. So it was interesting. We had made a preliminary location just based on studying the site plan that we had. And it turned out we were probably about 20 feet off from where we thought we were. But boy, we walked that whole site trying to find what we felt was the perfect place to drive the first stake of the center line of the front door. So a bit of an odd answer, I guess.
That's an important answer. You know, the people, they miss that.
What's so important to actually physically go to the site. I mean, when I was a builder, we used to do that. We used to rent lifts to see where the master bedroom window was going to look over, you know, the whether it was a golf course or Mountain View, whatever the case may be, to see what it's really going to look like.
Because you don't want to get up there by the time the second floor platform is up and all of a sudden go, wait a minute, I'm looking into the neighbor's dumpster. You really don't want
Absolutely.
That.
Yeah.
But and if you don't take the time to do that, it will happen.
Yeah.
You know, you got to dial that stuff in.
But it is really different how one thinks about placing a house in the landscape when, you know, we're on 60 acres, and there's a few trees, and it's just flat. And you can see as far. It's very challenging. So that's why my answer, that's been the most challenging thing in the last few months.
Well, you've really given us a lot of great information, and boy, Colorado and Denver is lucky to have someone like you that moved here with
all your
expertise. So kind of in closing, anything new coming up with Carta or anything to talk about that you can leave our listeners to ask for more on the message board and get to know Christine a little bit more?
Sure. Well, I'm looking forward to developing Carta over the next several years, and we will have our conference coming up in the fall. October 3rd and 4th are the dates for our conference. Will be immediately followed October 5th and 6th by the Traditional Building Conference, which is a conference done by Traditional Building and Period Homes magazine. We're actually hosting them here in Denver. So there's going to be some exciting educational opportunities here in Denver in the fall. Our whole college has a pretty dynamic lecture series that goes on across the entire course of the year. And I think probably the thing I'm most excited about being able to do is to develop these online educational offerings so that your architects and builders who are out there listening can actually learn a little bit more about traditional approaches to design and construction and windows.
That's great. We'll be sure to have some more information on our show notes page, too.
That's great. It's been fun, guys.
Thank you.
Wow, Devin, I don't know about you, my head spun a little bit with all that great information, but I think our listeners really will get a tremendous amount of good, useful detail out of that conversation with Christine. I mean, interesting how much knowledge she can impart, not only from a theoretical standpoint, but from a practical standpoint in terms of what she's doing both with Carta at CU Denver and then in her own building design. Pretty amazing stuff.
Yeah, CU Denver is lucky to have someone with that much knowledge. I mean, boy, she has put in the time and really understands the industry. And it's just so fun. I just sat back in awe listening to her talk about, you know, just the one segment that we're experts on in the window and door category. When we just threw out saying muttons and TDL,
yes,
she went into, you know, the detail of that segment and talking about when we went into the Baldwin thing where she just won that award and, you know, talking, you know, the rosettes and the details that, you know, we have a hard time just getting those, that segment of the industry right.
No, absolutely. And the thing that's so exciting is just the passion she has for all those details and for all of that information and really seeing that things are done in a way that makes sense and helping people move forward with that going, you know.
Yeah, and man, when we started this, I look back on shows like this and say, you give and you will get. I mean, we have given so much for the art of construction, but it's like we turn the mic off when she leaves Studio MVWD now, and it's like the resources we have from meeting these great people, from turning on this microphone and people listening around the globe and
you know, just the credibility factor for us all.
Yeah, and it's been amazing for us, but I think for those listening, for all of our architects and contractors listening, they can get the same benefit, which is really exciting to me.
We talked about that trip with Anderson, and I'm sitting here listening to her talk, and like the architects I've got to know from being in Bayport, I can't wait for them to listen to this because, you know, they're going to listen to that and be like, wow, I should open that door and check out CARTA and, you know, the ICAA and another perspective from Chad Cox, but the same but totally different.
Yeah, because it's not just for the up-and-coming students that are going to be architects in the future. They've got programs available from a continuing education standpoint for existing and current architects, which I think is impactful as well.
I think the architectural community is really hot on Denver right now, and what she's doing with all this new work through CU Denver, I think there's going to be a lot to come out of that. As the people I've met through ICAA and people like Christine that are focusing in that section of the architectural community, I think they're in really good hands, and we're pretty excited to know them, and can't wait to have her students come into the showroom and give back to the next generation of who's going to be designing our buildings, that she's really conscious of sustainability the right way and learning from the past.
And I would just recommend to people listening to check out our show notes page, because there were a lot of details there, and we'll have some links and some further information so you can pick up on a lot more of what she was talking about as well. So
yeah, I think you're going to see a lot of coming partnerships with these people you've seen on the shows coming out of the Art of Construction and collaboration that will really get everyone in the industry can get a lot out of.
Absolutely. That was great.
Thanks for diving in and having another great episode. If anyone else knows someone that would be the right fit for the Art of Construction, we'd love to hear from you, as we're getting a feel for this thing, and it's kind of got the legs and the tentacles are going out there. So, you know, Christine, when you listen back to the show, who would you recommend for us to come into Studio MBWD and just keep those nuggets going in the marketing gold and collaborating and working together, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely.
Thanks.
You have been listening to The Art of Construction. To listen to more, please go to www.mtnview.us and click on the podcast tab. Don't forget to like us on Facebook, and thanks for listening.